Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's the Weekend Water Cooler. I'm your host, Jean Bolduc, and I'm joined today by Damon Siles, our wonderful alderman from Carrboro. And Damon and I have just been talking for a moment about the topic of the day as we record today on Thursday for broadcast on Saturday, which is, oh my goodness, there's a meltdown underway.
Another one.
Another one. You know, it's the monthly meltdown in Raleigh at the General Assembly. I had to tear myself away from listening to Aaron Keck's coverage of this to come into the studio and record. And, you know, you're almost afraid to look away for what you might miss.
They're making a habit of this, aren't they?
They really are. And, you know, among many terribly unfortunate things, to me, one of the most terribly unfortunate things is that they probably have a couple of things in there that are not terrible ideas that are being brought into, I just don't know how to describe what it is, a tornado of negativity by how they're abusing process. So can you talk a little bit about how this is supposed to work, at least?
Well, you know, they originally were called into special session this week by the governor to deal with some disaster relief issues related to Hurricane Matthew and to the wildfires out west.
And they actually dispensed with that fairly quickly, right?
They did. And I think by all accounts, at least from what I can tell, that they passed a nice piece of legislation that will address some of the issues affecting folks who were really suffering in the aftermath of those two disasters. They apparently couldn't stop themselves and called themselves – the General Assembly called themselves into another special session. This will be the fourth special session of the year.
They had to close out that session, right? The one that the governor called.
Correct.
Because he called it for that specific reason.
Correct.
And so they closed that, and then they took it upon themselves to open a new special session, which they can do.
Right. With no particular topic presented as the reason.
Right. Now, these are special sessions, so these are separate from the short session, long session model that is normally used.
Right.
And typically, if I recall my North Carolina structure correctly, and I'm not sure it even matters anymore, typically, if you have a controversial issue or bill, it has to go in the long session so that as a matter of transparent policymaking, there can be committee reviews and so forth and testimony and fact gathering.
You are describing some key features of good government, yes.
Yes. That's in that old chapter of a book that probably is now out of print in the United States, if not here. And the short sessions are reserved basically for enacting the budget. And the budget is based on what's enacted in the long session. And this goes in biannually, right? So every other year you have long session. So this year, was it long session or short session this year?
We had a short session this year.
We had a short session.
We will have a regular long session beginning in, I believe, in January.
In January. And all of these issues that they're discussing couldn't possibly have waited until then, I guess.
Well, if we look at the couple dozen or so bills that have been filed in this special session, it's clear that what most of the Republican members of the House and Senate are interested in this short session, in this special session, is putting some things in place before McCrory leaves office.
Right.
And the new governor takes office. They know exactly what they're doing.
Right.
They've been planning this for a while. They are pretending that they haven't been planning it for a while. But it's clear both from the substance of the bills that have been filed, some of which are pretty complicated, and also from just the some documents that have been unearthed about how the special session was organized, that they've been planning this for a little while, and they know exactly what they're doing.
Oh, they plan, don't they? They plan. Some of these have to do with contracting the authority of the governor.
That's right.
I'm sure they would have done that if McCrory had won the race, right?
Right. So, you know, restricting the authority of the governor over certain kinds of political appointments, also restricting the governor's influence over appointments to the UNC Board of Trustees, boards of trustees, restricting the governor's appointments to boards of elections and to the state board of elections.
And changing those structures to combine that with the ethics board to make the state board a larger board and an even numbered board so they'd have to have a supermajority to do anything at all.
Right.
And then just out of curiosity, do you know – you didn't know there was going to be a government quiz when you came on the show, but do you know if they fail to get – if some matter comes before the State Board of Elections and they fail to get a supermajority, what is the appeal process? Does it, let me guess, go to the General Assembly, whatever that matter might be?
I haven't read the bill about State Board of Elections closely enough to know the answer to that, so – I know that they are presenting it as a way to make the board bipartisan.
Yeah.
As you know, under the existing statute,
right,
the state board and the county boards are the majority of those boards are appointed to be in line with the party of the sitting governor.
The majority of the governor, right.
And what they're doing now is making the county boards and the new state board, assuming this legislation passes, to be equal in numbers of Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing this because they don't want to lose some measure of influence over those boards, clearly. But they're framing it as an effort to make those boards bipartisan.
Yeah, because they're so worried about how Democrats improperly use their partisan advantage in these matters. I mean,
what's interesting is that part of the justification I think one member gave for changing the structure of the county boards of elections was that there was this trouble in Durham County.
Yeah.
Well, but we know from the recent historical record that, in fact, the Durham County Board of Elections, which, by the way, because the sitting governor is a Republican, was majority
right.
Republican.
Right. And they
it turns
the right
out
thing.
They were correct. And yeah. When they began their recount, they found that, in fact, the governor was not going to pick up votes there.
Right.
In fact, Cooper is the one who picked up a couple of votes
right.
in that recount.
Right.
So this is all cynical power grab. We know that's what it is. They know that's what it is. And I think the best phrase I've seen used in the social media to describe this current special session is revenge politics. They're upset that McCrory lost the election and they're out for revenge.
Well, that sums it up quite nicely, doesn't it? I mean, do you send flowers for revenge politics? I mean, what do you
No,
what
you
do
file you, bills.
You file bills. Yeah. And is it true that the Democrats could end up suing their Republican counterparts to invalidate whatever's passed because this was done because of the process, not because of the outcome?
I think there are a couple of pieces.
There are
a couple of pieces to that. One is that if there's some reason to believe that the way that this special session itself was called or organized,
right,
that could go to court.
Yeah.
I think Governor-elect Cooper and some Democratic legislators have also suggested that if any of these particular pieces of legislation are passed but don't stay – measure up to what they see as sort of constitutional or other legal requirements, that they are willing to fight those in court as well.
Right.
The governor-elect made a statement this morning essentially saying he plans to see his Republican colleagues in court and he hopes to do well against them. So,
well, maybe he will, especially if the bill that was trying to expand the state Supreme Court, that failed, right?
I don't think they ever actually introduced one.
Or maybe
that was one of the rumors.
I think
they've backed away from that. Even one of their own members a couple of weeks ago said it was one of the craziest ideas he'd ever heard. So they backed off.
Oh, my goodness.
That.
Can you imagine the universe of the menu of options that he had
right.
before determining the craziest thing? Oh, my goodness. That's a lot of options. You want fries with that menu of crazy. Well, this is really fascinating, and as I say, you know, I hate to be off the grid for even an hour. I think that the House is coming into session at 4 o'clock this afternoon,
yeah.
which will occur while we're recording, and they'll probably be in for the balance of the day. It's going to be a late night, I think, in Raleigh.
I think they'll be back tomorrow too.
Yeah, tomorrow. Maybe we can make them work Christmas Eve. What do you think? We can get it. Just let them keep
I'd
going
really
and exhaust
rather
themselves.
Not work
yeah, that's
anymore at all.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
a long way. They should all go home and start wrapping presents, right?
It depends on who they're for.
Yeah, well, the last present they sent us all, which is what we'll talk about when we come back, House Bill 2, that was a stinker. That was the gift that didn't give anything to anyone.
It's keeping on not giving.
Yeah, it's keeping on not giving. It's more taking than giving, I think. Yeah. Not very much not in the Christmas spirit. We're talking with Damon Siles, Carborough Alderman, and champion in general, we'll be right back. We're back with Damon Siles. We're talking here on the water cooler, on 1360 AM and 97.9 FM WCHL. where Chapel Hill listens. I must say, this is a time in our community, the last year or two, and I think probably for the next four, this is a time for paying attention, paying close attention to the details and to getting into the particulars. A little bit discouraged, I think, is probably a fair term, for how House Bill 2 was played as the bathroom, you know, how the bathroom bill thing caught on.
Right.
Because as you and I know, there is so much more in-depth power grab by the General Assembly in that bill.
Well, it's not an accident, Gene, that House Bill 2 was played as the bathroom bill.
I mean, that
was intentional, and it wasn't just a media pickup, right?
No,
It was convenient for the media. It's a great soundbite, but that was part of the strategy was to pass it off as this so-called bathroom bill because people get sensitive around bathroom issues, and it really appealed to people's kind of worst fears and. That's what they wanted. That's not only how they got it to pass so quickly, it's also how they got their base to be so energized around it.
And that's why it's too.
So polarizing.
Ours too, which I'm not sure that was not just fine with them. You know, go ahead and...
Sure. Well, they made a bet. I think there's a sense in which they won that bet. House Bill 2, regardless of the results of the gubernatorial election, is still the law in North Carolina. But they lost the bet in the sense that Cooper did win. Mm-hmm. McCrory is out, though it was close. It was a very close election.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that McCrory was a great champion of the bill. He would probably argue that he was a victim of that bill, and if he had it to wind back, he might have.
No, I think you're right, and I think you see that in the fact that he actually did not call that special session.
Right.
He elected not to do that, and so the General Assembly, the Senate and House, called themselves into session.
So they passed that ridiculous bill. They did this again with this utterly ridiculous process of claiming that they had to do this in a hurried fashion because it was about to the Charlotte ordinance was about to take effect,
right?
And they wanted to go in and protect the bathrooms of Charlotte and the rest of the state,
right?
With this nonsense process of passing this thing. On a lunch hour. I mean, even people who agree with the bill, and I don't know who the heck they are, but you know, let's just say that they're there and that they're well intended. Even those people, you just can't look at that process and feel okay about that. I mean, it's similar in some ways to the issue of the Russians hacking the presidential election. There does have to come a point where you just draw the line and say, "Hey, wait a minute, this isn't how we do it around
here." Right. As many of the listeners know, that bill was introduced and made its way to the governor's desk in the course of about 10 hours. So,
which is lightning
it's a ridiculous
fast.
Process.
I mean, that is lightning fast in public policy that's made in a day doesn't tend to be good policy.
Right.
You know, I think even as we look back. Now 15 years out to some of the things that happened right after September 11th, things that got in the way of civil rights in particular.
Right.
It might have been better to have a little more review and a little more thought process before, you know, ramming this stuff through on the emotion of the situation.
There are legislators to this day who say that they did not have time to fully digest and understand.
Right.
House Bill 2, which I believe is about a 4 or 5 page piece of legislation. It has three main parts.
I think it's that many pages if you use a really big font.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Because I printed it, and I'm pretty sure it was pretty short, yeah.
I think it's, you know, we're talking here about the General Assembly and latest developments and as well as older developments. We have an opportunity next year to make, I hope, some changes. As you know, the courts have called on the General Assembly to redraw some of the legislative district boundaries because of their essentially racist gerrymandering.
Yes.
So special elections will be held after those lines are redrawn. And that is an opportunity to use all of this energy that we say we
That's right. And the special election be in November, is that right?
I don't know yet.
Yeah,
I don't know. And actually, another important thing that I don't think we know yet is who will be redrawing the boundaries. I think if we ended up in a situation where the court redraws the boundaries, that probably would be a good thing.
Yeah. But the special election will be in 2017.
2017.
Period. That's going to be. I think it's a time to pay close attention. Okay. And I think that that's one of the things, certainly, that I'm going to be keeping my eye on the ball about dates and deadlines and, getting and making sure that, people may not realize that, you can register to vote again, even though this seems like an odd time to be thinking about that next summer or whenever it's going to be.
Right.
So how all that's going to work, that's only going to affect that's going to affect federal and state districts?
Those are the state legislative districts.
Right.
And it's not all of them. It's only a couple dozen, I think.
Okay.
We don't know what those lines are going to look like yet. So we don't know who will be affected, who we don't know how that's going to, for example, in our local districts District 50 where Greg Meyer is, or for Verla Insko's district, we don't know what those will look like yet or if they'll look different at all. So, stay tuned.
I think you're absolutely right. It makes it tough to campaign.
Yes. But you're absolutely right that this is a time to be paying attention and to be getting ready for what could be an important special election.
I say this all the time and often to, yelling it at my TV, which tells you something, that it's right after the big election cycles when a whole lot of stuff goes on, rules are changed and things go on in the parties. And people are exhausted from the election cycle and they're just not watching this stuff. And that's when the real mischief occurs.
Right.
So we'll just keep an eye on that. What is the process for overturning? Okay, we have a couple of pencils here on the table, but Damon didn't realize this, but these are actually magic wands. Wave your magic wand and tell me how do you actually unwind HB2? Do they have to just pass a repeal, right?
That's someone would have to introduce a bill to repeal it, and my hope would be, and I think the hope of many Democratic members of the legislature would be that statute, what is now part of the statutes, would be repealed in full.
Right.
But that would take a new bill,
essentially
making those edits,
That would basically name every single thing in the bill and say, not that anymore, not that anymore, not that anymore.
Essentially striking them out.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, why don't you start work typing that up today? Since it's such a short bill, it shouldn't take that long, right?
You can just photocopy that bill and
put a big red circle on it and line through it.
Yeah.
So who has that bill that we can keep?
I don't remember who introduced the bill in the last session. But the Democratic caucus does have a bill that would repeal House Bill 2.
Right.
It obviously hasn't gone anywhere because they have absolutely zero influence in the House and Senate.
Right.
So we'll see.
And not unlike the Congress, the majority decides what gets on the floor, what gets introduced, what's going to get a vote.
They write the rules. They have a supermajority in both houses. And
it's amazing that they even let the Democrats in the building when you think about it.
Yeah.
This is getting depressing. Well, here at the Weekend Water Cooler, we have things to cheer everyone up. I'm not sure what they are yet, but we're going to come up with them in the next half of the program. Very happy to have with us today Damon Siles, alderman from the Board of Aldermen in the wonderful town of Carrboro. Sent to us from heaven, Carrboro.
That's something worth celebrating.
Yeah, really. It really always is. I saw pictures from the Christmas parade, and I love Carrboro. Everybody knows that. And you're listening to 97.9 FM and 1360 AM WCHL. We'll be right back. We're back with Damon Siles. We're going to move on now to a topic of absolutely no controversy whatsoever, which is body-worn cameras. Carrboro, as usual, has been some of my favorite words: creative, forward-thinking, and comprehensive, I think, in its approach to community policing and the issue of body-worn cameras, even though, at least not to my recollection, you haven't had a police-involved shooting or a police incident that cause the community to sort of react and say, well, we're just going to have to get these cameras now.
Right.
It seems to me that after Ferguson, is that fair to say, that with all the attention on this question of creating, having a record and conflicting stories, which, you know, in journalism and in policing, we know that the eyewitness account is actually not the most reliable thing because of reasons of trauma and just human nature. People can, you know, two people can witness the identical incident and see completely different things, things that seem completely different because of their own backgrounds, because they have heightened emotional reactions. And this affects how we see and hear things and how we remember the order of events. Did the person speak first? Did they hear the pop, pop, pop of a gun? Did they hear that first? How many times? How many shots did they hear? And, you know, your memory is extremely unreliable in these circumstances. And it's not because, you know, any group of people tends to lie about things, either on the police side or on the civilian side.
Right.
So it is a great innovation available to us in the modern day to have this kind of technology that will create an objective record. And that combined with, I'm kind of revealing my position about this a little bit, but, you know, my position is always going to be that more facts is helpful, especially in a high stress situation. So tell me a little bit about, take me back to how this first came up. And I know that you've been extremely involved in this and spearheaded this, got involved with the ACLU and with Scarborough Police Department and other police departments too, right?
Right. Well,
in creating the policy.
In sort of thinking about what a model policy might look like. And you're right, this started a while back as the national conversation around police shootings reemerged.
Right.
This is not a new topic.
That's
this is
right.
something that's been
exactly
going on for
right.
many, many years.
Right.
It's something that over the last few years, as you mentioned, Ferguson really brought it again to the the front of everyone's minds. So I had already been doing some work with our Scarborough Police Department on some other policies unrelated to body cameras or cameras in general. But it became clear that that was something we needed to start working on. I knew that the police department was interested in exploring the use of body cameras and dashboard cameras. And I knew that there had been conversations going on in the community about the possibility of local police departments using cameras. So, you know, my feeling about it was that there really are two motivations for having the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
One is to build in some more transparency around policing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're describing one of those. One feature of that is having another perspective on any incident, right? And I think we need to be careful not to suggest that that cameras are going to provide a so-called objective view. They provide one more view. Right?
Well, a non-human view is what I mean by objective.
So they provide us with some additional perspective on a given incident.
That's right.
So on the one hand, we have this desire to have greater transparency, greater accountability on the part of the community who are looking to their police department to you know, police well and to do it with integrity, as I think we know that they largely do. And on the other hand, we have this motivation of the police department wanting to enhance its law enforcement practices and, you know, to have a tool available to them that will help them, for example, prosecute cases or, you know, bring charges, that kind of thing.
Right.
Also to offer training opportunities if something that happens, they can use video from an incident to improve their training.
Right.
So we have both of those things going on at the same time. Started meeting with the police department, with the police chief and his captains and others. Started meeting with some representatives from the local ACLU, meeting with other folks from an organization called the Orange County Bias-Free Policing Coalition, who had recommended the use of cameras, and started putting together a draft policy for how these cameras would be used if we purchased them.
Right.
So we then heard, after several months of working on this policy, we then got wind that our North Carolina General Assembly was going to be doing something on this topic. So that kind of—
Something said, wonderful, I know.
You know, we didn't really know what they were going to be going after, so we put the brakes on the work that we were doing and just decided to wait and see.
Yeah.
We didn't feel like it was worth continuing to work on this draft policy if it was going to be useless under some new legislation. So in fact, in this last session, the General Assembly did pass a bill relating to police cameras, mm-hmm. both any police camera, whether it's body-worn camera or a dashboard camera.
Right.
And the overall thrust of that bill is to define police video recordings and audio recordings as not being public records. In other words,
so that's a default position.
Carving them out in the statutes as a sort of special category of record.
Mm-hmm.
The bill overall is not completely horrible. And what I mean by that is that some of it is actually pretty useful in that it provides some common definitions and some common language around what are these recordings? How do we think about what they are as pieces of evidence and so on?
Right.
And setting up a process for understanding who's in charge of them, who has authority to release them, disclose them, and so on.
Right.
The problem with the bill is that it really restricts access to the videos. In the first place, it sets up two scenarios. One is called disclosure, and disclosure is allowing someone to view a video. In other words, come into the police department and sit down.
Like a defense attorney.
Correct. It could be a person who's in the video or their representative, their attorney, or whatever. Allows them to come in, request to view it. And in that scenario, it's the police chief or his or her designee who can authorize that disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
The other category is what they call release, and that would be actually giving someone a copy of the video.
Right.
And the bill, what is now law, does not allow that, really, under any circumstance, unless it's been approved by a court order. Even the police chief or police department cannot say, yes, you can have a copy of this video.
Right.
Only by court order can someone get a copy of the video.
And that's what created, quite a hullabaloo in the Charlotte case.
Well, yes.
Just recently,
the Charlotte case was interesting, and it just so happened to come just
like a minute after that was passed, right?
Right. The bill was passed, and the bill was to come into effect on October 1st.
Right.
The incident in Charlotte happened shortly before that. And the Charlotte Police Department, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department I think it was pretty clear they didn't want to release the video.
Right.
And they waited until that October 1st date came around.
Right.
And suddenly they couldn't release the video.
And then that becomes a whole thing all by itself, whether or not they were just dragging their feet to avoid the transparency. And then you've got that question where you already had people upset, and now they're questioning their trust in the police department.
The process,
And we're back to the process once again.
Exactly. So now where we are in Carrboro and in other jurisdictions is we have a new state law that defines who can access these videos. Mm-hmm. And under what circumstances they can do so. And that really changes – it has to change our approach to the draft policy that we were working on in Carrboro.
Right, right.
Which was – the problem with the bill is that, as I described, our two motivations in Carrboro were, on the one hand, transparency and accountability, and on the other hand, effective law enforcement.
Right.
Well, under this new law, the transparency and accountability piece of it really is out the window. And so what we need to do, if we're going to move forward with a camera policy and actually purchase the body-worn cameras, is we've got to think about what does a good policy look like under this new legal situation that we're in.
Right.
Now, I think there's probably still some value in having the cameras, but that's a conversation we're going to have as a community. I have talked a little bit with some folks who I'd been talking with previously about this draft policy. There was some general sense that they felt like there was still some value in having the cameras.
Right.
But this is not an ideal situation, and I can see where people would fall on either side of the line. The city of Durham recently has been going through the same conversation.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, they also, for lack of a better term, kind of a live situation that they're dealing with concurrently.
That's right. I mean, I think, it's
which makes it harder.
Durham has had some use of force incidents that have been, in the news, and It's one of the reasons that they'd actually felt some motivation to get going on getting cameras in place and having a policy for their use, or yeah. I should say, in their case, a directive from the chief regarding their use. They did end up agreeing in the last few weeks. The city council did approve purchase of the cameras, and the chief is going to have a directive to the officers on how they're used and how the data are maintained and all that. The kind of things that we've been talking about in Carborough.
And the, you know, the data issue, I mean, that's not small. I mean, it's about chain of custody is not as obvious as it might seem for other
right.
pieces
it, you know,
of
it turns
evidence.
Out that it really the bulk of the draft policy we've been working on in Carborough is really about how data retention schedule.
Right.
And the, as you said, sort of the chain of custody, who has access rights and privileges to the data. And being able to track that in the database.
Right. And is that just held on a master database somewhere? And is that on a network somewhere that can be hacked by someone? And
well, one of the things that my colleague Sammy Slade on the board has really been insistent about, and I agree with him completely on this issue, is that I think we need to be careful about where the data are stored and what entities have access to the data.
Exactly.
And I think we want to be careful about that, because what we don't want is, for example, anybody be able to just come in, for example, and access our videos without us giving them permission.
Right.
Whether it's the state investigators or federal people or private entities or whoever.
Right. Or, you know, or corporations who are looking to hire people and maybe screen people out that they want to not hire. And there's all kinds of implications that aren't even directly law enforcement.
Right.
Sammy, I remember that Sammy kind of raised the flag about that, and I agree with him. I think it's very, very complicated, and I appreciate you guys in how you, you know, refuse to be too quick about it. You know, when things are really important, it's really valuable to get it right.
Yeah, and I think we are planning to have an update to the board in January when we come back.
Mm-hmm.
About where we are. I'm going to try to do some more work on the draft policy over the next few weeks before that happens, just so that we'll have something to work with.
And with something like this, do you do a thing of reading the policy twice or passing it twice before it becomes?
I think what we'll end up, you know, if we get to a point where we have a policy that we're ready to really deliberate about, I think what we'll do is we'll probably have something like the equivalent of a public hearing.
Right.
It's not something that's formally required, but it
to
would be something. But of course, it's something
and,
like any agenda that any item that we have on the agenda at our board meetings, we would want to solicit and encourage public comment, whether it's in person at the meeting or beforehand by email or however. But we're not quite there yet. I think we're still at the point of having to reconcile what we had hoped to do with our policy. With the new the law,
right,
and it, I think if we can go as far as the law allows us to go in giving the town, the chief of police and the town manager flexibility in how they make the videos available to people requesting them. That's what we'll try to do, and then we'll just have to have a discussion as a community and as a board. About whether we think the restrictions now under the state law are too great to justify the expense.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm kind of leaning toward, I think there's still some value in having the cameras, but I'm not the only one making the decisions. So.
Yeah, is there any federal money available for that? I mean, I know
well,
there
that's
was.
Another point. Yeah. So in Carborough, we've actually already set the money aside in the budget. We have the money budgeted, but you're absolutely right. There are some... there may be some grant funds available that could help offset the costs or cover the costs entirely.
And DOJ was looking at doing that.
That's right.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, we've got one more segment, and we're going to be back in just a minute with Damon Siles, alderman from the town of Carborough. You're listening to the Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 FM and 1360 AM WCHL. We're back with Damon Siles for our closing moments here, and I was just... conveying to Damon how happy I am to see that this situation with the CVS building is going to be resolved now. That building's probably going to be taken down you know, forthwith, right?
Right. It should be coming pretty quickly. And that was a nice piece of good news to end the year on in Carrboro.
Yeah.
It's something that our mayor, Lydia Lavelle, has been working on for the last 2 or 3 years.
Great work, Lydia. Good job.
You know, she spent a lot of time and effort trying to really engage with the property owners over
right.
there to see what could happen. It didn't seem to be moving in a direction we wanted. And so
a little carrot, a little stick, it worked out.
Right. So that's right. Well, the staff kind of, and our attorneys and then kind of turned us on to this idea that we didn't really know we had the authority to do. But it turns out that the state law allows us to do this particular, to adopt a particular ordinance around mm-hmm. Vacant buildings and how
right.
they're maintained and so, or not maintained in that
right,
case.
Right, right.
So we adopted that.
Because it really was starting to look a little dangerous in
right.
there.
I mean, to me, and I've been saying this to others for a long time, it was clearly becoming a kind of public health issue. I mean,
yes.
the building
mm-hmm.
is falling apart.
Right.
And in fact, now that we have the new ordinance in place, our inspector did go into the building and mm-hmm. determined it was, in fact, falling apart.
Yeah.
It was a complete mess. And,
right.
And the property owners, I think once they got in there with the inspector, they realized pretty quickly that, yeah they agreed. The building
yeah.
needed to come down.
Not such good marketing for them either, by
exactly.
the way.
Exactly. So now what will happen is I think over the next couple of weeks it will go through this kind of a certification process, through it's
mm-hmm.
a state process, because they want to make sure that if they want to see if they need to pull any asbestos out of there, or, you know,
right.
that kind of stuff. And
when was that? Do you know when that building was built?
I don't know. It's been, 30 or so years.
I think it's 30, 35
yeah.
years. Yeah, there could be some unhappy materials in
right.
there.
And so they have to go through a state process of kind of
mm-hmm.
certifying all of that.
Right.
And then it'll just be a matter of getting
then they'll
the thing
just tear it down.
Down.
Yeah. And it'll become a little green pasture where tiny Carrboro cows will graze. No, probably not.
So I know that there are a lot of people in the community
parking
who
or something.
Would love to see certain kinds of things happen there. what I can say is that the property owners have already submitted a new application for rezoning of some of those parcels. So they have a project in mind there already. I think what I've heard, although I haven't seen the details, is that they have in mind a kind of scaled back version of their previous proposal.
Of what they were going
right.
to, they were going to move the CVS store from the Carr Mill location across the street to this property.
Correct. And
right.
so I think they're still wanting to do that. They have a modified proposal apparently in the works, and
right.
they've submitted a rezoning application to the town. So.
Right.
That's to be continued. I think we'll learn more about that as the new year comes around. Other exciting stuff going on, though, you know, downtown, especially the Shelton Station project on North Greensboro
mm-hmm.
Street. The commercial portion of that project is
right.
coming near. It looks like it's near completion.
Yeah,
that's going to be the new home of a great program at UNC that provides services to women who are pregnant or who are recently. Have had new kids, but who are dealing with substance use problems. It's a really wonderful program, and I'm so glad they're going to be in Carrboro.
Great.
But I don't know what else is going to be going in there, and that'll be kind of fun to find out.
Yeah.
There's another project coming up soon down at the bottom of South Greensboro Street called South Green.
Yes.
And we just learned in the last couple of weeks that the two of the first tenants that have signed leases are a new project by the owner of Acme, Kevin Callahan, and it's a taco bar.
Oh, fantastic.
And then another project, which is some local folks who are going to open a new local brewery. So that's coming soon.
You can't have too many breweries, can you?
Not in Carrboro.
Really?
No, of course not.
Not in Carrboro. Not a chance, no.
And then just down the street on West Main Street next to the new PTA Thrift Shop building,
mm-hmm.
they are doing part two of their project there and are building a second structure over there that will house, I believe they're going to house a youth center over there. So,
well, you know, it's Carrboro, so feel free is what I say.
That's right.
I came up with that myself. I've seen it 4,000 times on all of your documents. And the parking study was complete, and it basically determined that there's probably really enough parking. It's maybe not as clear to everybody where it all is at any given time.
Yeah, I think that's part of the story. I think the takeaway, the big kind of takeaway, as you said, is that we found that actually there is a lot of parking in downtown Carrboro,
yeah.
but it's a little more complicated than that.
Right.
And the reason that that's true is that a lot of that parking is really held in private hands.
Right.
And so
right.
it's not just a matter of, we've got tons of parking spaces, problem solved. That's not really true.
Right.
It's we need to work better with, I think, private property owners
right.
And figuring out a mutually beneficial way of managing all that parking.
Right, right.
Because a lot of it's tied up in private property, but it's not always being used.
So
right?
so some entrepreneurs out there are going to figure all that out.
Exactly.
It's going to be like water finding its level. And if we had more time, we would then launch into stormwater, but we're going to have to save that for another day, a rainy day perhaps. Well, Damon, thank you so much for joining me. It's been great having you. Join us all next week for the Weekend Water Cooler here on 1360 and 97.9 WCHL.